I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله الذي لا يحمد
That's Al-Qaeda's number three leader, Mustafa Abu al-Yazid, in a 2008 video message, a voice that's reportedly been silenced. For the first time, an Al-Qaeda website is reporting that al-Yazid was killed, along with his wife, three daughters, a grandchild, and others, apparently in a U.S. drone missile attack in Pakistan. Some Pakistani intelligence officials are confirming al-Yazid's death, while others aren't willing to do so because there have been so many false reports in the past. So what does all of this mean? Mark Hosenball is an investigative reporter with Newsweek. Mark, first, what are U.S. government officials telling you?
Well, U.S. government officials are telling me that they're pretty confident, in fact, quite confident, that this guy, Mustafa Abu Yazid, the alleged number three in al-Qaeda, was indeed killed in some sort of missile strike, presumably a missile fired from a CIA-operated drone aircraft sometime within the last 2 weeks, somewhere in the Pakistani side of the Afghan-Pakistan border.
Well, you said, alleged leader of al-Qaeda. What do we know about him? We've been told he was a founding member of al-Qaeda with Osama bin Laden and number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri. And the 9/11 Commission noted that he opposed the 9/11 attacks. So do we know that?
We know that as much as we know any of this inside al-Qaeda. There have been one or two defectors from inside al-Qaeda, and at least one of them testified, I believe, in court in New York that this guy, Mustafa Abu Yazid, apparently goes back with Ayman Zawahiri, the number two person in al-Qaeda, to the early 80s when they were both agitating against the Sadat regime. The testimony in court in the United States was that he actually handed out the regular salaries or stipends to the al-Qaeda fighters, and then he moved with the group and planted themselves in Afghanistan. And he had kind of been a sort of advisory figure, what in the mafia would be called a consigliere advisor to Osama and Zawahiri, more senior kind of thoughtful figure, quartermaster, not somebody out there necessarily on the front lines organizing operations, but as the other number three figures in al-Qaeda, including the 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and two or three of his successors, as they were either captured or bumped off, then apparently this guy, even though he was an older, kind of more established figure in the movement, moved more to the forefront and apparently became more involved in operations. And when you become more involved in operations, you have less time to hide out, and so you expose yourself more to getting caught or killed.
Well, we understand most recently Mustafa Abu Yazid was credited with bridging the gap between the Arabic faction of al-Qaeda and the Taliban al-Qaeda. Tell us more about that.
Well, there's always been resentments, both in the Pakistan, where most of these guys hang out, and in Afghanistan, where they used to hang out, between the so-called foreign fighters who come even from places like England or the United States to train with al-Qaeda, and the local tribesmen, the local insurgents, the Taliban, both in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. This guy's, one of his tasks apparently was to smooth the waters between the hosts and the guests. But again, in order to do that, in order to actually go out and be a diplomat, you have to expose yourself to greater risk of capture. And that seems to have been what happened in this case.
So as we know, he was reportedly killed in this U.S. drone missile attack, along with his wife and daughters. We know that the missile attacks, which President Obama has stepped up, have proven successful in killing top militants, but have also provoked a great deal of anti-American sentiment in Pakistan. What is your sense of this death on two fronts? What does it mean to al-Qaeda? What does it mean for that anti-American sentiment?
Whenever a high-profile person gets killed in Pakistan, a high-profile militant, it's going to cause some sort of outrage, ferment protest among that section of the very volatile Pakistani population that sympathizes with this kind of person. As for what happens with al-Qaeda, we see in the recent plots that have been uncovered here, for example, the failed Times Square bombing and the failed underpants bombing at Christmas time, we do see that as these drone attacks take their toll, we seem to be seeing a degrading of the leadership of al-Qaeda and the degrading of the quality of the operatives that they're able to send out into the world to actually conduct attacks.
Mark Hosenball, investigative reporter with Newsweek magazine. Mark, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
About 6,000 children in the U.S. are conceived every year through egg donation. When the practice first started in the 1980s, there was concern that the price paid to donors would slowly rise. And sure enough, look through any college newspaper, and you're likely to see solicitations for eggs from college girls with perfect SAT scores or blonde hair, some of the ads promising up to $35,000. And New York Times columnist Russ Doubthat reports on a new study from the Institute of American Values that shows that many of the children conceived through sperm donation are grateful to the fertility industry, but haunted by the feeling of being bought and sold. So what are the questions raised by egg donation? It's restricted or banned in a lot of countries where parents wait in vain on long waiting lists. But in the U.S., parents can look through books of potential donors as if they were catalogs. In a moment, ethicist Art Kaplan. But first, we're revisiting this topic because of an article we saw in the New York Times on Wendy Wilson. She's the founder of the Gifted Journeys Donor Agency and a five-time egg donor herself. She joins us from Studio City, California. And Wendy, first of all, what's the difference between boutique agencies like yours and IVF, infertility clinics, which also match donors with prospective parents?
Sure. We're here simply to screen and recruit donors, whereas IVF clinics do a lot more than just that. They work with everybody straight across the board.
Well, the key word is screen. So are you looking for a certain kind of donor?
Yeah, I think we always are. Most agencies probably turn down the majority of donors, and I would say the number one reason being for health issues. What agencies are looking for are who a doctor's office is going to accept. So they're going to look for a donor who's healthy, has a healthy BMI, doesn't smoke, doesn't drink, doesn't use drugs, doesn't have a particularly bad health history when it comes to hereditary or genetic illnesses. And then, of course, we're also looking to screen donors who intended parents are going to want to choose.
Well, that gets to the heart of this matter here, doesn't it? What is it that means to you? What are parents looking for?
I think the most common secondary to health is education. They want a donor who is attractive, usually a donor who previously a successful donor, of course, would make for one that a lot of intended parents would be interested in using. But as far as assets that a donor has, education and looks are very high up.
And ethnicity is one thing, but it's some of the other traits, you know, the way somebody looks, how smart they might be, that have raised questions about this. This idea that agencies may be trying to create perfect babies, and it borders for some on eugenics.
Right.
Or even just the distasteful notion that it's like choosing a baby off a menu instead of allowing nature to take its course, because any parent will tell you, you know, you can have two biological parents that have all sorts of traits and a child will come out and be a stranger to you.
Right.
So there's
exactly.
So nature has its own way, and this seems to be getting in the way of that. What are your thoughts on that?
My response on that is I don't think necessarily that it's agencies trying to create the perfect, attractive baby. I think what it is us responding to what intended parents are looking for. And the majority of the time, the intended parents are looking for donors that are similar to them. So what we see in the media as far as advertising for the $35,000 to $50,000 donor is pretty unusual. Most of the donors in the databases and agencies are around $10,000 or less. And also very normal girls, like college educated, but maybe not an Ivy League. Currently in college with average GPA, and we're still getting donors like that chosen all the time by couples or intended parents who have similarities to that particular donor.
Well, what about turning young women into products, you know, who can be bought and sold depending on their perceived qualities? You did this several times.
Yes.
How did you feel doing it?
Well, I was in the fortunate situation where I was able to meet the intended parents who chose me as their donor, partially because I worked in this industry for many, many years. And so not at one point did I feel like a commodity. The very first couple that I donated for, the intended mother could not have children of her own naturally because she had been in remission from breast cancer for 6 years. So I had the opportunity to meet these people, to hear her story and how badly she wanted children and how devastating this was for her when she found out that she'd never be able to have her own naturally. And the next best thing, of course, was to find a donor who had very similar features and similar athletic abilities and similar education and use that person as an egg donor and still have the genetic link to her husband.
So it made you feel good to do this.
Absolutely.
But let me ask you, have you had your own children?
I have not.
Do you ever wonder, how am I going to feel if, in fact, I don't know what your road leads to, but, you know, you for some reason don't have your own children and there is a child that is half you out there. Do you worry about having any regrets down the road?
I don't. I think myself and many donors included, and I've talked to many about this over the years, when we are donors, we don't look at these babies as our children. We want to have children with the mates of our choice at some point in life. And so we don't go back thinking of that with regret. In fact, I would say for myself and virtually everyone that I've talked to, you look back and it makes you feel good.
And you talked about the money. The American Society for Reproductive Medicine has guidelines, but these are not laws, they're guidelines, in large part to try to keep lower-income women from feeling compelled to do this because of the money. They say beyond $5,000 should require justification for why it's more, and payments above $10,000 are inappropriate. But we know payments are way above this.
Mm-hmm.
So, first of all, do you go above those guidelines?
I typically do not. To say that I never have would be untrue. I have, but not to the tune of the, you know, $25,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 that you read about. Of our 400 donors, 395 are going to be $10,000 or less.
Yeah. But still, do you feel that some women might do this even when in their heart they don't want to because the money's so good?
I would think not. There's a lot of options that women have in life to make money and certainly do things in a way that's not going to require them to undergo weeks of injections, a recovery period, and also part with genetics if we otherwise wouldn't want to. I think it's not giving women enough credit to, especially just because of money, to assume that we will only make this decision because of it.
Well, and you mentioned the procedure, which some women have written, they're shocked to see is more than just, well, it's not like men, let's face it,
right,
who have an easier job donating sperm and get paid a lot less for it. It takes weeks. It requires hormone shots. There is risk, abdominal pain, bloating, perhaps blood clots or kidney failure at one end. And what do you tell these prospective donors? Do you lay it on the line for them about, you know, what it's going to take?
Yes, I do. In California, they just passed a law also that in even your advertisements, you have to start putting the warning at the bottom of the advertisement of potential risk for egg donation. When they have an interview with an agency or certainly an agency that's doing their job, you go over all of those complications with them, and then you follow that up with all of the possible complications written as well.
That's Wendy Wilson. She's founder of the Gifted Journeys Egg Donor Clinic in California and a donor herself. We have a couple more questions, including how do you trust what donors tell you about themselves? We're also going to speak with ethicist Art Kaplan. What are his concerns? That's in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about egg donation and some of the high fees that are now being paid to donors, $30,000 to $50,000 in some cases. In a moment, we're going to bring in medical ethicist Art Kaplan. He has some questions. But we've been speaking with Wendy Wilson, founder of the California-based egg donor agency Gifted Journeys. Now, Wendy, you said you don't pay upwards of $50,000, but you often pay $10,000. And we're wondering, are you concerned that women will falsify information about themselves in order to reap these higher payments?
I think that's a concern with all agencies and all intended parents because there isn't a lot. There's only so much we can do as far as screening the donors. Some things we can get proof of, such as transcripts. I think the bigger concern is, are they falsifying their medical history? And to a certain degree, when it comes to things that we do not have the ability to test for, we have to hope that the psychological evaluation and the screening on the side of the agency is going to be enough that we all feel comfortable moving forward with that donor.
And have you seen any of the children created with the help of your eggs?
I have.
What's that like?
It's great. It's great. It's pretty exciting that you see this child that's there because of something you helped do, and certainly something you helped facilitate, and there's kind of not a better feeling in the world.
That's Wendy Wilson, founder of Gifted Journeys, also a five-time egg donor herself, speaking to us from Studio City, California. Wendy, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Robin.
Let's bring in Art Kaplan, the well-known ethicist from the University of Pennsylvania. Art, the reason we're talking about this again, we've spoken about it in the past, is that there are reports that people are going way outside the guidelines in paying young female egg donors upwards of $35,000, $50,000. Your thoughts?
Well, first, let's get one thing clear. If you're getting $30,000, you're not an egg donor. You're an egg seller. One of the ways that this whole field has evolved to try and downplay the importance of money is to continually refer to what they do as gifting or donation. And you can argue about the pros and cons of allowing people to be egg sellers. But when you're getting 10, 15, 20, if I said to you, I'd like to help you, I'd like to give you a ride, I know you need a ride downtown, but it is going to cost you $20,000, I doubt you'd see me as making a gift of a ride to you. Look, there are all kinds of agencies out there. The one that Wendy represented is one style, if you will, but we've had a couple of studies done at our own center of asking young women to call up and say they want to sell their eggs, and they get all kinds of responses. Some say, sure, come on down. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. Others say, well, what school are you in and what's your grade point average? That might bring you a lot more money. One way to rank colleges around the United States is not to pay attention to the U.S. News and World Report rankings, but just see who gets the highest prices for egg sale.
And by the way, who is that?
Princeton.
What's wrong with that, Art Kaplan? If there are parents who can't conceive and they decide that they want to have a child, what's, in your mind as an ethicist, wrong with making sure it's someone who does have a high grade point average?
Well, for one thing, that's not how genetics work. If you looked at your own family with the same parents and the same environment, how did your siblings turn out? Are they identical? You can't guarantee that by having a grade point average that's a 4.0 or going to a fancy school, something isn't going to happen that's going to recombine the genes when they're mixed up in a dish and produce something entirely different. You may raise the odds a bit, but you're not going to breed people the way you do cattle unless, if you will, you do it for a long time and really get purebreds. If it worked that way, we would see, you know, generation after generation after generation of all siblings sort of being high producers. But that isn't how things like intelligence or athletic ability work. I'm not going to say, you know, there's no influence of genes, but I'm not going to buy the argument that if you want to hunt up your best donor, you're well served by spending $60,000 for the Princeton egg. There have been one or two cases where parents said, I don't want this baby because you didn't give me what I wanted and walked away.
Really?
In other words, a baby with a birth defect, yeah.
Really? So there are,
it's a sort of a product liability thing. You know, you gave me a bad product. I hired you to get me a perfect baby, and you've produced something I don't want.
Oh, boy. So if this were not paid at all the way it is in other countries, in which case there's a waiting list for parents. These parents have to wait in agony because there aren't that many people who will do it without being paid. So are you against the payment at all, or is it just this sort of paying some people more than others for this false sense of getting a better egg?
A little bit of both. I think the only people, in all honesty, who donate eggs are usually family members. Everybody else who's a stranger starts wondering about the money. I don't think there are too many women who are going to say, yes, give me powerful hormones, overstimulate my ovaries, put me at risk of having one of them burst. And there are deaths that happen from hyperstimulation to make a lot of eggs. And we don't really know the long-term consequences, but I'll do that out of kindness for a stranger. I think what we need to concede is that you have to get paid some reasonable amount for what you're going through, for what it will take you to, you know, be involved in this process. But when you start upping the ante and selling the fanciest egg or the athlete egg or the Nobel Prize sperm, I think then you're playing on popular culture misconceptions of how you're going to improve things. So I wouldn't say I'm thrilled about the market, but I don't think there's any other way, you know, to sort of get people to sell their eggs. But I don't want monetary amounts up there so that a young college student isn't thinking about the risk. And I don't think it's fair to run around pretending like use our egg bank and we'll guarantee you some sort of perfect child.
Art Kaplan, thank you so much for weighing in on this issue that seems to have really grown in the last couple of years. As we said, 10,000 children born with the help of egg donors.
Right. I think it's pretty fascinating, and how we make babies tells us a lot about our values in some fundamental way.
All right, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Yesterday, dozens of people gathered, as most of them have since April, on Alewife Brook Parkway here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's a dangerous four-lane road, home to strip malls and the huge glass-front office building we're now standing in front of, staring up at a nest of red-tailed hawks.
Buzz and Ruby, yeah.
That's Ernie Serro, a fitness instructor for the elderly turned de facto documentarian. He named the parents Buzz and Ruby and has been videotaping and blogging on the progress of their offspring, Lucy, Lucky, and Larry, who was named after Boston Celtic great Larry Bird, by wildlife photographer Andy Provost.
I've been watching 9 red-tailed hawk nests during the spring, and
wow.
8 are on buildings.
Really?
Yep. It's uncommon to have a nest that's this visible.
Really?
A community has grown here, rooting on the birds' every move. Earlier today, the moment they'd all been waiting for, Larry fledged, took off for his first flight, and now he's coming in for a landing.
Hey. Look, what's that?
Yep, that's...
Is that the baby?
Yep, that's the youngest.
But the crowd gasps as Larry hits the building and spirals down into the busy street, where he sits as big as a fire plug. Pandemonium.
Let him go! Let him go!
Yeah, he may be stunned.
Oh, no.
Oh, come on. Oh, he's right in the street.
Can't
someone get her blanket so she can wave it? Get that blanket.
Another regular, Hildy Martis, heroically runs into the street and stops traffic. With her blanket, she shoos the bird back up and into a parking lot behind the building. Ernie and the rest of the devoted followers regroup.
My God, this is unbelievable.
That...
All right, hopefully it's going to fly. We're going to hope this thing flies. Larry fledged at 6:10 this morning, and he wound up landing on Circle Furniture. Yeah, there he goes, frolicking on top of Dunkin' Donut and Circle Furniture. And then he was on a telephone pole back here in the back. And everything was going hunky-dory. He even made an appearance right at the pinnacle.
Oh, look, there's...
Oh, I think this is the father by the sculpted head. I think it's the father. And he's overlooking... This is wonderful. I mean, they are great parents. Buzz is not a absentee father. He sat on the eggs once the chicks were there and Ruby wasn't around, either hunting or whatever. Buzz would come in and actually feed, actually put the food right in the mouths of the little ones. The lesson for children is fabulous.
It was getting late. I had to leave and came back a few hours later to find that Larry the hawk had moved from the parking lot to the top of a telephone pole. Ernie was in the same spot.
I tell you, my legs are getting tired. You know, there's a lot of hope for Larry.
But this has turned into a lot of work. You're down here with your camera. And not only that, it's an emotional commitment.
It is. Right now, I am drained. I have to say that.
Why are you doing this?
It gets to be a compulsion. Life is unfolding in front of you. I don't have to worry about this the way I have to worry about the oil leak in the Gulf, which is depressing to me. It's a sickening thing. And I think of all life that's being hurt as a result of that. These are issues that are hard for me to face, hard for me to take, and I don't see the way out of it. And then I look at something right here, right in front of us, unfolding right in front. It's life, it's nature in a very unnatural place. Nature has a life force. It's why grass breaks through the ground. I get to document that. I get to see that happen in front of me. And I get to see all these people excited about it. And little kids getting picked up in front of the cameras. And they're going, wow, and ooh. And I had this Indian family. They were either Indian or Pakistan. The excitement came through. You understood just what they're saying. And when that happened, I said, this is just great. Oh, this is looking good. I think
he's
it likes
spreading
the
his
wind.
Wings.
Oh, I think it likes the wind. It's
amazing.
Trying to get the confidence. Please. I'm hoping so much that he's just in a safe place for the night.
Well, Many fledglings don't make it through their first flight, and except for a little shooing out of the road, humans must stand back and watch. But good news. Today, Larry the Hawk was sighted a little bedraggled after a terrible thunderstorm last night, but perched on a railing one step closer to his nest. You want to follow the drama? We'll link you to Ernie Sarrow's website at hereandnow.org. Go, Larry. Back in 30 seconds, here and now.
If you return from combat and have concerns about your mental health,
the tools and the resources are here now.
Make use of those services and stay strong.
Give them a chance. It can make a difference.
Use those resources. Get strong again.
Do yourself and your family a favor and use them.
Ask for help.
Stay strong in body, mind, and spirit.
Remember your words.
The voices of some of the 28 Medal of Honor recipients participating in a public service campaign to urge other veterans to get help for post-traumatic stress disorder. Unspoken, the hope that the campaign will reduce the alarming number of service member suicides. Retired Army General Patrick Henry Brady is one of the participants. He received the Medal of Honor for bravery in Vietnam. On January 6, 1968, Pat Brady landed his helicopter ambulance in a minefield in heavily defended enemy territory and, with his crew, helped to rescue dozens of American and South Vietnamese soldiers, many of them wounded. And he joins us from San Antonio, Texas. General Brady, welcome.
Thank you.
And you've heard the reporting about post-traumatic stress syndrome, and we'll link listeners to our reporting. But initially, returning troops were told that they were sissies if they had PTSD, then told that the symptoms were real, but they might be because of pre-existing conditions, you know, before combat. So there's been a lot of controversy as to whether or not it's even diagnosed. But now, do you think that the care that you're urging that vets get is available?
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. I was a medic for 20 years in some very, very stressful situations. And there's no question that soldiers are reluctant to admit that they might have anything that would cause other people to believe that they were less than macho people. But I will say that we've been attentive to this thing over the years. And today, we do a lot of things better in the military than we ever did. And when our people are hurt, when their families are in need, the military is there to help them.
Well, it used to be called shell shock at one point as well.
Yeah.
And you talk about it not being available for veterans of the Vietnam War, as do other veterans in this campaign. How about you? Did you return and realize that you had any of these symptoms?
No, I didn't. I had some guys who worked for me and others that I knew who did suffer. And in one case, one young man who was with me in the minefield, in fact, the day I got the medal, nobody in the minefield would move. Many of them were wounded. And so I told my two crew members, they looked at me, and I said, go get them. And they jumped out, and they started loading the patients. In the process, they stepped on a mine, blew them up in the air. I was looking out the back door. I thought they might go through the rotor blades. But they came down, landed. One of them had his flight suit on fire. He put it out. They got up, dusted themselves off, and continued to load. Well, when we got back, I says, go to the hospital. And I thought they did, but only one of them went.
Yeah.
And the other guy did not go, even though I didn't know about that for many years. This guy subsequently began to have many, many difficult problems because of that day. And to this day, he suffers from it because he wouldn't go to the hospital. He brought it home with him. It affected his family life. It affected his life. And that's just stupid. And to this day, we're very attentive to him, those of us who served with him, to make sure that we do all we can to help him. But he has suffered from that quite a bit.
Boy, I tell you, what I'm taking from that, General Brady, is, you know, you can't imagine anyone going through that, even you having to watch it, you know, and not come back with some problems.
We had a 40-man detachment. We had about 26 of them shot during their tour in Vietnam or wounded in some way. And now as they get older and they age and they go to take care of their physical problems, many of them have shrapnel in their body, bullets in their body, they're being tested now. In other words, the guy will sit them down and say, what other problems do you have? Problems that may be related to PTSD or suicide or anything like that. And then they're able to treat him and bring a little more comfort and peace into their lives.
So are you in this campaign speaking not just to Iraq and Afghan war vets, but to veterans of the Vietnam War who might decades later need help?
You bet. Now, my daughter served in Iraq, and she was a medic also. and she tells me that this is a very real thing. We have got a significant problem with suicide because of PTSD and other stress-related things that these kids go through in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, General, I'm wondering, the stories we see on the website, and we'll link everyone to the website of the campaign, but there's Drew Dix, who went house to house, taking back an entire town in Vietnam from enemy forces.
Mm-hmm.
There's Joe Jackson, who landed on a tiny runway under fire, rescuing troops and then taking off on this short runway again under fire.
I was there that day.
You were?
Yeah, I was. Just happened to be in the same area. Never knew Joe at the time, but it was a really, really horrible battle.
Well, and every one of them is a movie in and of itself. It's heroic. That's why you're all Congressional Medal of Honor recipients. But do you at all worry that, you know, an Iraq or Afghan war veteran who, you know, to us they are all heroic, but who might not see themselves in that same way and might, you know, hear this campaign and think, oh, I don't measure up, you know?
What we did and the medals that we got were simply a function of someone seeing what we did, caring enough to sit down and write it out. All these other kids that I flew with every single day did everything as well or better than I did. And Drew Dix and Joe Jackson and all those guys will tell you the same thing. The day that I got the Medal of Honor was certainly not the worst day I had, but nobody saw it and wrote it down. Everybody that I served with in Vietnam who was a medevac pilot did the same thing I did, day in and day out. We thought in Vietnam that we weren't worthy of the medals that our heroes in World War II, for example, got, but that's just not true. As a matter of fact, I'm just a little disappointed that from Desert Storm through today, the only Medal of Honors that have been awarded have been posthumous. These kids are every bit as heroic as we were or anybody from any war was. And also, the repeated deployments. One kid was kind of an aide to me the other day at a military function. He'd been in the military 10 years, and 6 of those years had been spent in deployments, and he had a wife and 2 children. That will cause stress. But the good news is, everything that can be done is being done. The impetus now remains with the individual. He's got to realize that there are Medal of Honor recipients who have the same kind of problems he has, who have had PTSD, who have been suicidal. They just need to come forward. Nobody's going to make fun of him. Nobody's going to say a damn thing about it. The guy's just got to do his part.
Retired Army General Patrick Henry Brady, one of 28 Medal of Honor recipients participating in the public service campaign to urge members of the military to get help for PTSD. General Brady, thanks so much.
Well, it's my pleasure. We appreciate what you folks are doing to get the word out.
Spring is here, school's almost out, vacations lie ahead. What better time to pretend, if you're not already there, that you are on a California beach?
For the country electro, things smelled like earth. For the country electro, things smelled like earth. Flies cooked all night.
That's the Country Electro, one of the tracks off Man of the World, the latest CD from ALO, or the Animal Liberation Orchestra, more on their name in a moment. The band's been touring almost constantly since its second release on Jack Johnson's Brushfire Records. Two of the band members join us, keyboardist Zach Gill, Zach hello.
Hello.
And guitarist, is it just Lebo?
Yeah.
Just Lebo?
Yeah.
Join us in the studios. Welcome to you both.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Well, Jack Johnson, Hawaiian-born, son of surfer Jeff Johnson, got a huge following of his own. How do you know him, Lebo?
We all went to college at University of California, Santa Barbara, and we lived in the dorms together, actually. And then one night we hung out and all played music together. We realized we were just all good friends.
And we formed a super band.
Well, and now he is producing, and you're being published on his Brushfire Records. Mm-hmm. So what does he bring to it, Zach?
We had never worked with a producer throughout the entire process. And we're kind of, you know, we're a group of old friends, and I think Jack was able to fit right in, but in the role of a producer. We all felt comfortable to bring our songs to him and to sort of speak openly, and I think that was maybe the best thing. You know, he kind of helped guide us on our path.
It doesn't hurt that that path leads you to Hawaii, to his Mango Tree Studios.
I mean, it works out pretty well.
Let's listen to the title track. Now, this is one that was written by you, Zach, and Jack Johnson. Let's listen. Man of the World.
He's a man of the world. He's a man of the sky.
Zach, if you had to describe the sound of ALO, what would it be? Oh, boy. This could take a while.
Thunder and rainbows.
Lots of rainbows.
It's definitely relatively sunshiny on the surface.
It is.
But down below, there's plenty of turmoil.
Well, I want to listen to another song, and I understand this one had some inner turmoil in it. It's called Suspended. Zach, tell us about this. I mean, it was one take, recorded in one take, and what does this reflect?
You know, we grew up together, and we've always had this sort of, and I think internally we have this desire to sort of play these long, grand pieces of music, and then we have this other side of us that that wants to make things concise and short and wants to be popular. And I think that Suspended felt like freedom to us.
Yeah.
And Dave said it reminds me of the song sounded like the place where Vikings go to die.
Yeah.
And
what was going on? I mean, it's the heaviness there. You want to call your dad, Levi?
Well, this song was really cool because we were actually going through, it was a little chord progression we'd been just kind of jamming on about a month before. We're like, oh, let's dig that one up. It was like midnight. Everyone was like really relaxed and just open to whatever was going to come out, and it came out that way.
The lyrics, actually, it's slightly personal, but my wife was pregnant and she miscarried, but we're pregnant again and we're well underway and we're having a baby and it's looking good. But I think that was kind of what's all at the same time. It was just an emotional time.
First of all, ALO, Animal Liberation Orchestra, I'm betting that that gets you in some interesting
terrain. All the time, yeah. All the time.
Do people think it's the Animal Liberation Front?
We've actually shown up to a gig and the marquee said that.
Oh,
which
gosh.
Was very misleading. Because that's not our trip at all. You know?
And we should remind people this is a radical group that often carries out illegal acts to release captive animals that are used in laboratory experiments and fur farms and things like that. But what is Animal Liberation Orchestra?
Now it's come to mean the animal is the unconscious, it's the instinctual, it's savage. And I feel like the orchestra is uptight, it's in a suit.
Organized.
And it's organized, it's composed, and it's conscious. One is unconscious and one is conscious. And I think the two coming together, we're looking for this way to fuse them in a way that's balanced.
That's our struggle, in a way, I think.
Liberating your inner animal.
Right.
Here in nine, it's not too much.
Well,
I just want to note another thing, that all the band members are products of music education classes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too, you know. Oh, let's hear it for...
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, absolutely.
Mr. Cohen, in my case, your music teacher. And those classes are an endangered species. Well, they're gone, you know. So you're what, taking some money from the CD?
Yeah, we do all quite a few of our tours. We actually do fundraisers for a program in California called Music in Schools Today. And they help, you know, fund these public music programs that used to get state funding and are now, you know, getting, like you said, slashed and cut. And they're kind of stepping in to help keep some of this going, because really, like, I mean, in high school, we had so many opportunities to study music in high school that I know. I have a friend who's got a little sister who's at the school now, and he's telling me the classes they offer, and it's just a fraction of what we had.
Right.
And I don't think any of us would be the musicians we are today without that.
Well, now you're donating a percent of all the proceeds from the new CD to the Music in Schools Today program.
Yes.
So we'll let people know more about that program at our website. But meanwhile, you know, the music, as we said, can be very laid back. Some critics have wondered, gee, so laid back that days after people might just sort of forget. They, you know, sort of, but there was a thing that happened, this music that wafted through. I want you to pick a song that will maybe dissuade them of that notion, you know, it's laid back, but.
I Love Music is laid back, but not.
Laid back, but not.
Yeah, check it out.
I love music. You love to dance. When we're together, it's the perfect romance.
That's Zach Gill. He plays keyboards, and Lebo Dan plays guitar in the band ALO. Their latest release is called Man of the World, and they do love music. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Guys, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
From my soul to the soles of your feet. From my soul to your soul to the soles of our feet.